The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network
on News Talk.
Well, now it's time for our Friday Forum, and we're joined by Daniel McConnell, political editor with the Irish Examiner, Sinn Féin TD for Cavan Monaghan and spokesperson on disability and carers, Pauline Tully, and by Alan Farrell, Fine Gael TD for Fingal, the party spokesperson for climate action. Now, the big story of the week, strangely enough, was a letter in the Irish Times from Sabina Coyne Higgins of Dublin 8, and the Taoiseach said it's all over. Danny, has it gone away?
By and large, I think it probably has. I think the clarification that Sabina Higgins issued the other day in terms of setting out the circumstance of the letter being issued and also being put on the website, I think is by and large addressed. My colleague Alison O'Connor had a pretty trenchant piece in our paper this morning setting out, you know, the President and, I won't say the First Lady, but his wife, you know, they've had a habit of pushing the boundaries of the constitutional limits of their office. And I've largely...
You said their office?
Well... You know, you buy one, get one free kind of thing, you know. But, like, in fairness to Sabina Higgins, she has done the state a considerable amount of service in conjunction with Michael D. Higgins since taking office in 2011. I've been one who has largely celebrated the fact that rather than just sit quietly in the oars, he's actually looked to provoke a national conversation on many issues, particularly, and I thought his intervention on housing was definitely, if not pushing the line, then certainly stepping over it. But he's not wrong. You know, the thing, he wasn't wrong in declaring housing emergency a disaster, because it has been a disaster. But in terms of this particular thing, I think while Sabina Higgins is absolutely entitled to her personal view, the wisdom of putting it up on the website, the President's website, and leaving it there, taking it down, and then taking several days from a PR management, taking several days to explain yourself, that was a difficulty, Pat. That's where the issue arose. And I think the fact that it happened at the start of silly season, you know, obviously just amplified it.
If it was okay to put it there, well, why take it down?
Well, that's the point. And that's the judgment that has to be made. Now, her clarification is that she's had essentially a subsection on the President's website for her views and her issues to be kind of articulated.
Yeah, but who knew? I certainly didn't know. I mean, unless you were expecting a presidential visit, you might not check the itinerary to check where they'll be and what they're doing.
No.
And I haven't had reason to do
that. And there wasn't a clarity as to whether or not she was speaking or this was, an opinion okayed by the ORS.
Yeah, but presidentofireland.ie, whatever it is, president.ie, so that's the President's website. It is not the President's wife, children, Uncle Tom Cobley and all site. It's the President's site.
But if it was a separate site, i.e., Sabina Higgins, and it was an offshoot, clearly demarcated kind of offshoot of the web, I think there may not have been such a problem. The fact, I think, it was a pretty, the sentiment of it was certainly open to ambiguity and certainly open to criticism, I felt, in terms of there was an equivalence or an apparent equivalence being made. I think she's come out to try and clarify that, and obviously the statements of condemnation in relation to Russia are certainly welcome. But I think if I was handling, in inverted commas, the first couple, I would have said, this is something you need to address pretty quickly, and they didn't, and that's ultimately what led to the controversy.
All right, Pauline, what do you make of it?
Look, I think it's a little bit like Daniel said, it's a silly season and there aren't enough of other issues there to focus on. I mean, I think she's clarified her position. She's reiterated her condemnation of Russia. And I think what she was calling for was basically a ceasefire and negotiations, or to try and bring about that, and that others should take a role in that. And that's every conflict we know of has to come to an end by negotiation. So, so what she was saying wasn't terribly wrong, and she has clarified her comments. And
no,
she
but
has
the people that your party supported for 30 years, it took them 30 years to get to the negotiating table. Circumstances had to arrive before the troubles would end.
Yes.
The Ukrainians and Russians have only been at it since February. The game is not played out yet.
It's not, but I mean, look at there's a number of people who've been killed, a number of people injured, the destruction of property. We're talking about climate change, the damage to the climate as a result of this war. There's a lot of different issues here that need to be looked at, and it's a ferocious war. It's every day. It's every day for the last 4 months. So I mean, look at the players, the big players in the world need to try and use their influence to bring about a cessation if they can, and a resolution. Okay, and that's not saying that Russia's wrong or Russia's right or anything like that.
The presidency, and as Danny has said, buy one, get one free, and they are seen as the first couple, as Danny has also referred to them. If they played it badly, Yuri Filatov played it brilliantly to discomfort Ireland.
Yes, but look, he's been using every opportunity.
I know he's discredited and so on, but still.
He's used every opportunity he has been presented to him to try and present a different view, if he can. So, and he has discredited himself before. So this is, you know, look, people are not taken in by what he does.
I know, but it plays in Russia. I mean, this is, you know, we think that we're isolated out in the Atlantic, but at home, the Russians are being told, Russian citizens, that the president of Ireland kind of thinks there should be a ceasefire and wants peace and all the rest of it. Yeah. And they use that.
Well, it wasn't the president. It was the president's wife, and she's a private citizen.
At the president's
and
website.
Just, yes, I know. But she, as she said, it was a
you're not
that
you're
she
not
uses,
really
you know?
A private citizen if you start embarking on forays into foreign policy. Alan.
Yeah, and I think that's the crux of the issue. It's not that Sabine Higgins has a track record in this particular field, one that is to be credited, but it's that the letter, which was written by a private citizen, an unelected private citizen, was then published on president.ie, and the distinction internationally is irrelevant, and that's the difficulty that has arisen as a result.
Has
of
she
these.
Sorted it though?
I think her response was very defensive, and I think it missed the point, if I'm quite honest. I think for her to not refer to, you know, to the charges of false equivalency adequately, either in her first letter or indeed in her second letter.
You're saying that there seemed to be a parity
They're both at fault. They're not. And I mean, just
that
to
was
correct,
clarified, though,
just
wasn't
to,
it?
Just to correct you, Russia invaded the Ukrainian sovereign territory in 2008 and again in 2014. And those lands were still held by them on the 24th of February of this year when this war broke out. But this is an unjust and unjustifiable action by a tyrant who is now being, you know, at the centre of sanctions that are being implemented.
So when I said it was a relatively short time in play, you're saying no.
No, not
actually,
at all.
This war is 14 years in play.
It has been around.
Putin wants more.
He wants more. He wants clear access to the Black Sea. He wants, presumably, the other angle that has been considered by many people over the last number of months has been that there are oil and gas fields in the seas off the southern coast of Ukraine, and they will get access to those, which will destabilize the region, not to mention the agricultural impact that we all know about. But I read an interesting article, Pat, on journal.ie there the other day by Professor Donico Bracon in DCU, which really kind of covered my own views quite well. And the publication of the letter gave the people from the outside Ireland certainly an element of presidential legitimacy, which of course was picked up by Yuri Filatov and used, as you say, for propaganda purposes. And I don't think that is the biggest issue that I've had throughout this. I said it the day it was published in the Irish Times, that my problem wasn't the fact that Sabine Higgins has a view. My problem was that it was published on president.ie.
And also your problem being that the clarity wasn't there. But I'm reminded of that mantra, when you're explaining, you're losing. And that's one of the problems.
Yeah, but the difficult, but Pat, people have made mistakes in public life and made, you know, city commons. But time and time again, if you shut it down quickly, if you do a mea culpa quickly, problems can be solved and moved on, and people can move on pretty quickly. It's the failure to respond. Mm. And as Alan says, if you dig in and double down on it, then you kind of compound the problem.
Yeah, we do kind of afford almost a sanctity, though, to the president and his or her spouse. You know, we don't intrude upon them. Mm. We photograph them when they go to open the garden gate or whatever it might be, but we don't normally intrude upon them. And then suddenly, you know, you get something from Sabine Higgins like this. Which
it's been interesting because normally the president, the office of the president and everything related to the ORS is above sort of party politics and the sort of squabbing. And politicians of Alan and Pauline standing normally, you know, are slow to kind of get in to criticise Michael D. Higgins or any predecessor. It has been noticeable, the kind of rounded condemnation from pretty much all sides as to the wisdom of all of this. And that is sort of somewhat uncharted territory.
By the way, she signed the letter, Sabina Coyne Higgins, Dublin 8, and people were wondering, how come the Phoenix Park is in Dublin 8 and not Dublin 7? And Joe Duffy, I heard him explain this, that it goes down to where the mail for the ORS would be delivered, which is to the James Street post office, which is in Dublin 7.
I lived in Island Bridge for a number of years.
Or in Dublin 8, and that's why it's delivered to Dublin 8 rather than Dublin 7. Because I lived in Dublin 7, so I know where it should be, but it ain't. It's Dublin 8.
But it is in Fingal, interestingly. Okay. Not in Dublin City. There you
Not
go.
Not in Dublin City. All right, we move on to the other story that preoccupied a lot of people, and this was the suggestion that gardens could be shortened in order to densify housing stock, not by building upwards, building the same sort of two-storey houses in rows or terraces or whatever, but with shorter gardens. Alan, what did you make of that?
I think it's an interesting suggestion. I'm not going to come down on it negatively or positively, but what I would say is that every angle we should consider in terms of ramping
every
up
idea
the
that's
supply.
Come from developers has been disastrous. Well, what I was SHDs, what, disastrous. Co-living, disastrous.
What I was about
single
to say,
aspect
though,
apartments,
Pat.
Disastrous. I could go on.
What I was about to say, though, was that there have been times when we have changed regulation in the past and it hasn't been successful. In fact, it was flagged at the time, both internally and across the floor of Dáil Éireann, that it might not be the thing to do. I would question the wisdom of doing this at this particular time. However, one of the most important aspects of the particular publication by that particular developer was in relation to land use in cities and the acceptance that apartments should be delivered in cities. But outside of certain urban environments, that apartments should be discouraged. And I'm not at odds with that at all. I'm actually in favour of that. But our biggest issue that we have in this
why?
Country...
I mean, the idea of apartments, for
so
example...
So if you can imagine around a suburban...
If you go to Germany, for example, you get towns, and they will have apartment blocks, not the monsters that we have in Dublin, but they might have four-storey, five-storey blocks in, if you like, the immediate suburbia surrounding a town centre. Works very well. What they're doing in Cherrywood, which is in County Dublin, surrounded by green fields, farmland indeed, they're building 5-6-storey apartments around a town centre. Mm-hmm. That'll work.
So the difficulty that I have isn't the Cherrywoods of the world. The difficulty I have is rural Ireland, where you have a town centre with maybe a population of under 1,000 and an apartment building going in. That doesn't make an awful lot of sense to me. And it's not exactly desirable either. So what I'm, and it's also expensive, because these properties, because of the standards that we apply to them in terms of building regulations and fire standards and things like that, once you go above a certain height, you have additional costs that are built into that extra floor or
but
floors
no
above
one is
that.
Saying they have to be 5 or 6 stories high. Do you know what I mean? Like, you, as I say, continental Europe, you'll find 3-story, 4-story apartment blocks pretty much everywhere scattered throughout the hinterland. And it works because all the services are delivered cheaply and so on to each of the people, rather than one-off housing in the hinterland, which is very expensive to service.
It is, and that has forever been our biggest problem in terms of servicing properties down, you know, rural laneways. But if you go back to the city centres, I think our biggest difficulty, and it was shown in recent planning decisions by Dublin City Council and indeed by An Bord Pleanála in relation to specific zones in Dublin City that were designed for high rise but that were rejected by the planning authority. And you have to ask yourself the question, well, what is the point in having high rise density guidelines with a cap on height specified by the local authority?
But
refuse?
You know, the Player Will site in Dublin 8, with which you're familiar, I'm sure.
I am familiar.
You know, building went in there that was outside the county development plan heights and so on. And, you know, a minister or whatever can just with a stroke of the pen change the environment for everyone living there. I mean, that's not exactly democratic.
No, I think, though, that when local authorities don't necessarily adhere to their own councillor driven plans and density guidelines for the city centre, you have a problem. And I think people then question rightly as to what it is that we're aiming for. City centres and urban environments are perfectly fine for medium density or high density, depending on where you are. But when you go outside of that, I think you need to change the narrative to building communities.
Pauline?
Well, I think the day of developers making planning rules and setting the agenda shouldn't
well,
even...
they're allowed to lobby, in fairness.
They're allowed to lobby.
You know, make their suggestions.
Planning needs to be a democratic and transparent process, and it needs to be done through the local authorities or through the Oireachtas. Now, the government, I think, were looking at guidelines on density. And I suppose I'm looking out for them to publish that, because the city and county plans are already about to be published, and these plans
which
haven't
been brought
forward, you know.
They're ignored by the board, even though there have been a number of court cases which found against the board on the basis that they should be adhering to county development plans. But they seem free to ignore all of these things.
Well, look, I mean, maybe the board needs to be a better resource, councils need to be a better resource, but I think the planning process has to be done in a democratic way, and it has to be done through the councils and through the Oireachtas. And look, we do need to look at different models. Somewhere like Dublin and Cork and the larger cities and towns need to look at apartments. But they can be properly planned apartments. They don't have to be monstrosities. As you said yourself, there's very good examples in Europe. We need to look at those, and they can be built at a cost that's a lot less.
So narrower streets and shorter gardens for the houses that we are building in suburbia, which Alan would like to continue building houses rather than apartments in suburbia. So to get density, the developers are saying shorten the gardens, have no front gardens, for instance. But then if you've got narrower roadways, which they're talking about, how do you charge your electric car that you're being told to have?
Look, everything's area specific as well and site specific. So you need to look at those. I mean, you can't have one rule for everything. You know, everywhere's different.
Well, as someone who has had various properties between large gardens and small gardens, I saw the value of the garden during COVID-19 with three small kids. And you know, we'd be loath to kind of sort of give that up. But also as well, I think the argument needs to be a much more rounded. I mean, like, it's one thing having a shorter garden, but like what we did see through the pandemic is the value of green spaces and the need for kids to be able to go out and run around. And if you don't have that, or if you don't have a sufficient garden space that you can actually have, you know, raise kids in, then that does create
the rules they want from 22 metres between the back windows of two opposing houses down to 16 metres. And they pointed out that the intervening 6 metres is not used by people. And I was wondering, okay, so you don't put your deck chair down there because it's perhaps in the shade, but also the fact that you're looking at your rose bushes at the end of the garden, that's use as far as I'm concerned.
But it is. But again, it's been overly prescriptive because it fits, like, obviously from a developer point of view, if you can put 20 houses in on a site rather than 15, there's a value for doing that. And
but do you believe it'll cheapen the houses, or make the selling price cheaper? Because I don't believe that's the case at all.
Not a bit of it. And this is like, I mean, the motives, like, developers have been villainized for good reason for many parts of the last 15 or 16 years, but we still will need developers to build houses. So, I mean, we need to listen to them, yes. But I don't see any other motive. I don't see this coming from a position of social good or anything like that. I see this as a profit-driven motivation, and it therefore needs to be treated in that sort of a context.
Why is it? Does anyone know why other cities can build apartments and make them affordable and usable and our developers can't?
Well, the suggestion is that the standards that we apply, which I cannot see any difference between, say, British standards or our own, or French standards or our own, in terms of fire safety, noise abatement and stuff like that. So the argument,
and is it simply the land?
The argument falls on its face. Well, the biggest aspect, of course, at the moment is the cost of the materials to build the property. But heretofore and throughout the last number of decades,
I mean, there are apartment complexes being launched before the war in Dublin City, you know, 450,000 to 500,000. You know, that's before the war, before supply chain issues and all the rest of it. Why can't our guys produce apartments at the same prices as they do in provincial English cities? Not in London, London's special case.
So the argument that's been put forward on a number of occasions over many years is that our economy is small. And we don't, and our land values are higher than commensurate land values in other jurisdictions.
And yet we've loads of land for our population compared to Britain, which is concrete pretty much all down its spine. England is. We've loads of land.
I think, though, the value of land, and I mean, Danny made an interesting point there in relation to the value of public open space in the context of this discussion about garden lengths. I think it's a really interesting one, and it just goes to show the importance of it. There's communities right across this city that have very poor standard public open spaces built into housing estates, some of which are not in the charge of the local authorities. That adds to the problem. And when you then suggest that you reduce your garden size, and I think Danny hit the nail on the head, to what end? What's the public good here?
I will give you an example, guys, because I remember this. When they designed Darndale, the idea was that people wouldn't have those individual garden spaces. The aspect of each house would be so that they weren't overlooking each other. There would be cars only on the periphery, not inside the complex. And it gave rise to huge social problems. In other words, a brilliant design idea perhaps badly executed, but it just did not work. So I'm very suspicious of people who come up with these great wheezes that may, in effect, become...
Location is so important. I visited really top quality housing developments, particularly in Copenhagen. In fact, when I was a local authority member, we went over to look at a particular development in the former Dockland area of Copenhagen. It was a fascinating exercise. But as you say, you know, if you look at Darndale, you'll be very familiar with the community there. I passed it on the bus when I was knee-high to now. The difficulty is location. Where you put it is what makes a community thrive or not, dependent upon the development or the design, I should say, of the development.
It's location, but it's also supports for the people, the families that are there. So it is having sufficient green spaces. It is having sufficient youth facilities, you know. So you need all of those supports. And it also depends on who's going to live there, you know, as well. And it, like, I often think that a lot of support could be given to families who you can identify at an early stage of who will need support, because maybe there's generational poverty in the family. And, you know, that's not done. The investment isn't put into these families at an early stage. And then instead we end up spending a lot of money at the other end, putting people in jail.
Finally today, I don't have too much time to talk about it, but Alan, you were having a go at Sinn Féin over their green credentials.
I was. I think the primary reason for that was in relation to the fact that their climate policy, particularly in relation to the sectoral targets that were agreed there last week, they didn't have one. They were waiting to see which side they would drop.
OK, well, it came down at 25%.
They were waiting to see which side it would drop and then criticise us on the outcome of the agreement at a cabinet level. And I think that's no way to be a main opposition party. I questioned their policies, Pat, because I serve on the committee with Sinn Féin, and I have seen the populist streak in Sinn Féin in relation to not just sectoral targets, but even the Climate Action Bill, which I think we in the Oireachtas of all parties and none should be very proud, because the committee played such a significant role in amending it.
Your party is equivocal. Waits to see, if you'll pardon the weather pun, which way the wind blows before it jumps. On the 25%...
I think this is rich coming from someone who's a member of Fine Gael, who've been in government for 11 years, and how we've seen year on year an increase in emissions, and every single target that was set missed. And they're going to miss more targets this year.
OK, so what do you think of the 25% for ag?
But we weren't given the information that the government was given.
Yes, you were.
We were not. Not given it.
Why did every other opposition party come up with a figure? Why did every NGO come up with a figure?
They came up with a pie in the sky figure of what we would love to see happen. But it has to be realistic.
So what is your figure?
We will support the figure there.
I'd be surprised if they have one.
Excuse me. But the thing is, the whole plan around climate change is not targeted. It's not going to bring people with you. It's not going to help those who most need the support to actually retrofit their houses, buy electric cars or so on. We have some very good proposals around all of those issues. And
Alan, they've great proposals around these issues.
We have.
Not to my knowledge. And as I said, I've been working with the committee for 2 years and I haven't seen a specific proposal brought to the committee.
You've been watching all of this.
Okay. It's only taken 25 minutes to get into the party bashing, so it's great to see it finally at last. But what I will say is that we did a special report on Sinn Féin about 5 or 6 months ago, where we actually went to them and asked questions on every portfolio. And it came back, their stuff on agriculture, their stuff on climate was by far the most watery, the least convincing and the most vague of all of their answers across the board. They do not have a strong track record in relation to this. They are absolutely right to be criticised, because they did sit on the fence in relation to the sectoral emissions. And, you know, Pauline can try and throw it back on Fine Gael, and those criticisms of Fine Gael's performance in government are legitimate. But Sinn Féin are now being looked at as, the wannabe government, the party you're going to be in government next time around. You are open to criticism, legitimate criticism, that your policies in relation to climate and agriculture are nowhere near where they need to be.
All of the policies that Fine Gael and this government has put forward are going to help those who have the ability to pay. Look at the one-stop shop.
Does Sinn Féin support culling the national herd, as Eamon Ryan would like to do, in order to make it 30%?
If you look at culling the national herd, and then we listen to what Brazil are doing now, and they're increasing their herd.
So
and then what
yes
we're going
no?
to see then is a Mercosur.
No, what's your policy?
This government is actually in favour.
What's your policy,
we're opposed to Mercosur. No, In terms of cutting the national herd? We need to work with farmers to actually reach the mission.
You don't believe the national herd should be cut?
The government has absolutely no implementation plan for delivering these targets. We will have to leave it there.
My guest there, that was the voice of Pauline Tully, TD, Sinn Féin TD for Cavan Monaghan, spokesperson on disability and carers. Before that, you heard Danny McConnell, political editor with the Irish Examiner, and Alan Farrell, Fine Gael TD for Fingal, the party spokesperson on climate action.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.